The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. And how is your hangover if you have one this morning? Because hangover is the word that jumps out from the front of the papers today. The Irish Mail are the ones who actually use it. Warnings over 700 million COVID-19 welfare hangover. But it does feel across the papers like that we've all had, like, whatever, a year and a half now, wrapped up in puffer jackets and being pumped full of economic painkillers by the government, and that we are having to wake up and smell the coffee here. The Business Post: government prepares to concede on corporate tax rate of 15%. And there are pieces across the papers suggesting that we're being buttered up for that climb down, if that's how you want to see it. The Sunday Independent is that the COVID is still with us, of course. Taoiseach indicates that jabs on the way for over fives. What he's saying is if they get approved by the EMA, and if the medical advice here is to give them, he will give them. I think a lot of people suspect that they have a far easier and faster plan as to how to confer immunity on the 5 to 11-year-olds, and it doesn't involve giving them jabs at all. I think that's what some people think. Just let it rip there, baby. The Sunday Times: hospital reveals 49 nurses have refused vaccine. This is kind of extraordinary, mad stuff. So trade union source, this is in Beaumont, right? Trade union source have said there's a strong anti-vax movement in Beaumont. Some staff appeared anonymously on a live stream hosted by Gemma O'Doherty, the conspiracy theorist. The video described them as whistleblowers. It's daft stuff. The Irish Sunday Mirror: a similar story, and you see, this is where all this stuff gets kind of dangerous. This is that story of, you know, Joe McCarron, right? Joe McCarron was 75, and he was encouraged basically by anti-vax campaigners to leave Letterkenny Hospital in Donegal. They were telling him, you know, he shouldn't be in there, and he was in danger in there and everything. And he came home, he's brought back into hospital, and he died. And people are up there, his family and friends, quite upset about that. The Sunday World: Kinahan pal hunts 1 million raiders. Mass jewellery thieves are threatened after CCTV shows them robbing safe from Morris Sines home. And the Daily Star Sunday: I do enjoy the Daily Star Sunday front pages every Sunday. This is Eamon Holmes is talking, and the headline is "Snowflakes are trying to get me sacked." And we can all empathise with that one, Eamon. I hear you. Now, our panel this morning: Dan O'Brien is Chief Economist with the Institute of International and European Affairs. Niamh Horrigan is a sociologist and Vice President of Mary Immaculate College, UL. And Larissa Nolan is a journalist. And good morning, and you're all very welcome. And I'll ask you to put on your headphones first off, guys, because we're going to talk to Professor Luke O'Neill of the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning, Brendan.
Luke, you're just back from a big conference in Munich with the immunologists from around the world. And what were your takeaways from the conference?
Well, it was very exciting. My first conference in 18 months, can you believe it, face-to-face. So that was a tremendous thrill. And a student of mine, Tristram Ryan, came, presented our work on COVID, so he was very happy with himself as well. Well, that was amazing, man. I mean, there was 100 immunologists in person, first of all, and hundreds live streaming is what we do now, you see. So it was a fantastic gathering, and the relief, Brendan, that we're all together again. That was one sense that we got from it. Endless talk. I could talk to you all morning about it, obviously, but a huge amount of science. What got me also about the social bit, Brendan, we met for coffees, and so, scientists are very sociable, as you may not have realised, but we met for coffee, there was two receptions. They all said to me, how come Ireland's done so well? I was so proud about it, you know. A Norwegian guy said, you become like Scandinavians, you're as good as us with vaccines. You know, so that was a bit of a thrill.
Right,
but
yeah.
Endless talk about the virus, obviously, and what's going to happen next on various topics.
And what's going to happen next, Luke?
Well, the good thing was there's a huge consensus when we're coming out of it. Let's start with that. And there was lots of talk of next spring, for instance, being a key turning point, because by then we should have 85% of people either vaccinated or infected. And that means they're protected, you know. And what that means is the virus has gone endemic. And if you do catch it, you'd have symptoms like the common cold. So several people were saying, look, this will become like another coronavirus, which is nothing to be as fearful of. So that was a very good caveat abound as usual.
So obviously, the worry was, and the worry still is, I guess, for a lot of people, that there could be a new, worse variant on the way. But I saw as well, I was quoting yesterday, Dame Sarah Gilbert, one of the women who created AstraZeneca. She's saying now there's unlikely to be a more virulent new variant, and she's saying it's going to become like the common cold. Is that a consensus view now across immunologists?
No, I wouldn't say it's consensus. It is a view. There's a reasonable chance it might get more benign. Other viruses become less troublesome as they spread, you see, and maybe this one will be like that. So that's a reasonable thing to say. But it's an unknown, to be honest, Brendan. The number one thing we talked about, the biggest concern is new variants, of course, cropping up that are more malign. And, of course, the message is very simple, get the vaccine out. In fact, one speaker spoke about the big companies are making billions of doses now available to the developing world, which is tremendous, you see. So we must get the vaccine to developing countries. That's the key mission.
And the second thing is that stops the variants.
Yeah, that stops variants. It absolutely stops variants. And the second thing is the booster issue was discussed. One interesting comment friend I heard was, don't call it a booster, call it a third shot. So for some people, they will need a third shot of the vaccine to really protect them. That could be older people or people who are more vulnerable from deficiencies and so on. So not everybody should be getting a booster by any means. It should just be in those who need it. And just say certain groups need three shots, you see.
And the immunity is holding up well enough in the healthier population. Yeah?
It is. Very, very much so. And lots of data on that now. If you're under 60, for definite, your immunity is sustained. And it could be sustained for months and months, you see. If you're over 60, there's a strong case for a third shot if you've got AstraZeneca, because that one is the one that seems to be waning more, you see. So again, there was a general view, let's give boosters or a third shot to those who need it. And every country is beginning, as we are ourselves, And in fact, a lot of comparing of notes, Brennan, every country is, all the developed countries are starting now their third shot.
And of course, we have that situation where the only people who really got AstraZeneca here after the initial period were people from 60 to 70. So they definitely need another shot of something.
That's right. That was an anomaly, in fact. In other countries, it wasn't quite like that. More likely to get Pfizer. In Ireland, as you remember, we gave AstraZeneca that age group. So they definitely should be given the third shot in the form of an RNA vaccine.
Okay. You said there a minute ago, I meant to ask you about it. You said 85%. The way I thought we had given up on the idea of herd immunity, that it had gone up and up and up, and then they had basically said, look, we don't know if we'll ever get a kind of herd immunity. Is there a consensus developing around 85% of the population as being herd immunity?
Yeah, because of Delta. It used to be 70, it's gone up because Delta's more transmissible. Now, 85%, it doesn't mean everybody needs to be vaccinated. It means that vaccination plus infection, if you know what I mean. And there was discussion of children becoming infected and not needing to be vaccinated, for instance. Because obviously, if you get infected with Delta, that means you're protected against Delta, you see, which is a good thing,
So am I right in thinking so? Is that better than getting a vaccine? Better than getting one of the original vaccines that weren't tailored to Delta?
It's safer to give the vaccine, obviously. There's still a risk to children, remember, and the vaccine is a safer bet, But you're weighing that up against giving your surplus away to developing countries so they really need it. That's what the debate is, in a sense. So at the moment, it's wise not to do the under-12s, but to give the vaccine away, because the variant is a much more sort of imminent threat in some ways, So there was discussion around that too.
Okay. So you're saying that at the moment, on balance, don't vaccinate the under-12s, but am I right in thinking, and Cliona Caligh talked about this with us here a couple of weeks ago, and she's talking about it again in the Business Post today, that basically is the choice, like if we're looking at a pandemic of the unvaccinated now, the under-12s are the unvaccinated, is the choice there that they're either going to get it or we vaccinate them? So if we don't vaccinate them, are they all going to get it?
Yeah, there's a good chance, absolutely, because that's the way the virus works, you see. Now, clearly, with our mitigation measures in schools and so on, you're hoping to slow that down and protect them. It's an important thing. So, but there's no doubt in a normal infection, everybody gets infected eventually, So again, you would head in that direction. But again, if we manage to get enough of the adults vaccinated, there's less of a chance of children getting infected anyway. So you lower the rate of infection in that group. And then, of course, if they get infected, it'll be a mild, benign disease in the vast majority. So this is all part of the discussion that we're having at the moment.
Okay, Luke, will you stay with us a minute? I just want to bring in the panel. Larissa Nolan, there's a lot across the papers today about this notion of the schools and everything else. And obviously we heard this week that they are going to stop contact tracing now in the schools. Where do you stand on all that?
I think that we're rightly bringing in a bit of balance into the school, into the handling of the schools. Definitely the previous thing where kids were being kept off school for 2 weeks and no homeschooling in any of the cases that I heard, if they were in contact with a COVID case, I think that was personally, that seemed to be falling on the, you know, too much harm to the education of children against the risk in the case. So there seems to be a bit of balance coming into it at this stage. Very interesting to hear there from Luke, and I think that a lot of parents maybe accept that the kids will all get it at some stage. I think we've heard that now from a number of different people. Another thing that I was interested in hearing was that recently from Chris Whitty was that about 50% of them have had it already, which was something that I hadn't considered either. But then, so what we're faced with next, I suppose, is the do you vaccinate your children if they fall in that under 12 age groups? And again, I'm very interested to hear that Luke is falling on the side of the risk benefit, going, no, we don't vaccinate them. But it's definitely going to be the next question that, that we're all facing, those of us who have kids in that age group.
Yeah, and the Taoiseach certainly seems to be in favour of it, speaking in New York during the week. Dan, you were looking at that big piece in the Business Post, COVID in the classroom is sending kids to school, putting them at risk. What's your read on it?
Well, I'd just like to ask Luke. I remember Luke and I were on a TV show around, I think, May of last year, and trying to tease out the data, and I'm obviously not a doctor, he is, and but I look at a lot of data, and that it looked, the risk of death for kids was about the same as being of dying of a car accident, because COVID is just not serious for kids. And I'm just wondering from Luke if anything in the data that he's seen ever since then has changed that.
No, not at all. And it's a very, very mild disease. The tiny minority, of course, do get really sick, you see. So that's been in our minds. But it's a really benign disease in children. In fact, at the conference, Dan, there was a great talk on that and why kids are able to fight it. They've got a fantastic immune system, you see, so young, and they can fight the virus. And again, that informs this debate over risk-benefit. And remember, if we don't give the vaccine to developing countries where they really need it, and instead give that vaccine to a child, that's unethical, you see, because we could have saved loads of lives in a developing country, whereas to save a child's life, you'd have to give 100,000 kids the vaccine, you see.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that's part of the discussion as
Dan,
well.
Dan, I feel there was intent in your question. Well, is there a question?
We have to look at the costs of all of this. You know, we have a million kids in this country. Every single one of them has had their education affected by lockdowns and shutting schools down. How many kids have died in Ireland in this jurisdiction? The CSO, the Statistics Agency, won't even publish the numbers because, for confidentiality reasons, the numbers are so tiny. Now, we have to weigh up the risks. You damage a million kids' education tiny risk.
Do you think we overreacted then?
I do.
Is that what you're saying?
From very early on in this, I think we have, particularly in this country, we've had a sort of catastrophic conversation around COVID. And I've noticed many Irish people who live in other countries have commented on it to me. People who live here who are not Irish have commented on it. We tend to catastrophize things in a way that's kind of worrying, and it stretches into other parts of national discourse as well.
Well, our schools were closed for longer than anywhere else. That's another fact.
Okay, I'm going to go back to Luke on that if I can in a sec. But first, Niamh, do you think Dan has a point here?
Because
we're now
Dan.
Being told that schools are safe. I mean, I know I heard Aoife McLeish say during the week, schools aren't magic, but they are saying to us, schools are safe. Look at the damage we did to education in the last year and a half. And you've seen it,
I suppose, from somebody who comes from a background working in kind of the initial teacher education space. So I think it's actually very difficult for teachers because there's been such conflicting messages in the last 18 months. So we had this incredibly long school shutdown, which in particular, and this cannot be underestimated, the damage that was done to disadvantaged children.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Who are lost. Some of those kids were just being barely held, particularly in adolescents, were just being barely held in the system. They are now gone. And it's so interesting, you know, as somebody who does a lot of work in disadvantaged communities, the strength of feeling against not vaccines, but lockdowns is so intense in those communities now. And it really was about the closure of schools. So I think there's a very welcome recognition that, you know, if COVID is the only thing you can die from, then yes, closing the schools for that long is merited.
Yeah.
But there's lots of other things that can have a really long-term impact in your life chances, and closing schools is one of them. So that's one piece. On the flip side, it has to be said, and this is again coming from working in that space, is that I think, you know, listening to Micheál Martin's comments today and the comments about the Pfizer vaccine, there will be undoubtedly a lot of teachers in particular who will be very anxious and welcoming the news that Pfizer may have a vaccine for the 5 to 12 age group and will want to see that rolled out in some shape or form.
And I was talking to a teacher as well who made an interesting point to me that a lot of them now feel they're going to be in a class not knowing, because like we've gone from like maybe overdoing it to now it's like nothing, no antigen testing, nothing.
Correct.
And it could be there, 30 of them could have it asymptomatically in front of you and you don't
if
know.
If you think of it from the perspective of a teacher who might be pregnant, say, for instance, and is still going in and out of maternity hospitals where these have enormous restrictions, your partner can't come with you still in one of the cases, and then you're going back into a class of 20 or 30 kids, you don't know who has COVID, you don't know what's, you know, so it is enormously, and I think that's the mental health piece and the kind of burnout piece of people trying to constantly readjust as the goalposts shift is massive, particularly at this time as people try to move.
But Brendan, your point about the antigen is a really good one, because I don't know why we're refusing to see this as some part of the solution. It's been completely, in my view, in a kind of a form of sort of ideology around the antigen testing. In Britain, as last time I checked, families of children of school-going children were all given 5 tests a week. The children are testing themselves. It's a culture of testing.
Yeah, I think maybe twice a week, I think.
I think at one stage, I think it went up to being able to be 5 times
certainly
a week.
Okay. In my city, when I went looking, I actually went to buy antigen tests the first week that the kids' schools were back for all kinds of reasons, and they couldn't be had. They couldn't be had anywhere in any pharmacy in the city.
Yeah.
So there is people
who get
doing
them
it anyway.
In garages.
Yeah. So, Luke, I want to go back to you on a couple of things before you go. One is just if we hark back to Dan's point about, and I don't think in fairness that you would be accused of this, but did we catastrophize too much in this country? And then the knock on of that, did we do incredible damage, admittedly with limited information, but in what we did to kids and what we did to schools? I didn't expect to be having the post-mortem this morning, but seeing as we are where we are, let's just think about it for a minute.
It's hard to know, but obviously this will pan out in the coming months and years. I mean, damage to children and education is a massive negative, isn't it? And we did have a very stringent regimen here compared to other European countries, for definite. And we may live to regret that, but we just don't know. But I guess it was a moving target. It was huge fear. You know, it's hard in retrospect to say, did we get something right or wrong? Yeah. I do think, though, we're sitting in the thick of it, Ramon.
Yeah.
And we should keep up with the contact tracing. I mean, that's
should we? Because we do seem to be winding it down. Should we keep up the contact tracing in the schools?
I'd like a clearer explanation as to why we're not, because it's a very good weapon to use, and it certainly would reassure teachers, as we've just been discussing. Teachers, remember, should be vaccinated and then should be less fearful. That's the first thing to say.
Okay, so are you not, you're not convinced by Philip Nolan came out very categorically to talk us through it, which was basically, and look, I'm going to paraphrase him here now and I won't get it exactly right, but he basically seemed to be saying that yes, the cases are going up at the moment, but we see this bump every time we open up the schools, that this is also a result of there being way more testing of kids, because, and that's a good thing because people are doing the right thing and getting them tested, but that what is emerging is that there is a very low level of infection among close contacts in schools, that it is more likely in households and other settings, that schools are, in a way, as Aoife McLeish would say, a little bit magic.
I don't know how they can know that exactly. There's got to be uncertainties around that. There may be some data supporting that. But for the next month or two, into the winter, for instance, we should be using every weapon we have still in the context of schools.
So you think they should be contact tracing the contacts of a case? And do you think those kids should be staying at home for a while and getting tested?
In the next few weeks, until we see the data really clearly. Now, it may turn out that Philip is right and then we get less concerned about it. But at the moment, it's still unknown, in my view. It's too early. The second thing, I think someone said there,
antigen
the Germans,
testing.
In schools in Germany, mass antigen testing in schools the whole time, you see. They always deployed that as a weapon, you know?
Okay, is there any downside to it?
No, not at all. I mean, remember, it's another weapon. You've got to see all these things as extra ways. None of them are foolproof. None of them give you 100% certainty, but they're another thing to reassure us, really. And a lot of this is about reassuring teachers and pupils and parents, you know. So why there wasn't extensive antigen testing in schools all through this is a mystery to many of us.
Yeah, of course, we should be careful to say that, like, an antigen test is not a reassurance, really.
No,
like,
but you can explain that to people, can't you? If you're positive, you stay home. If you're negative, you assume nothing. That was always the message.
And Luke, before you go, you said there, remember, we're still in it. So obviously there's a feeling around. I mean, even the optics of like shutting down the hotel mandatory quarantine, which a lot of people thought was daft in the first place anyway. There seems to be a mood that we're very much moving out of it. Do you think we could have a tough winter ahead of us before we get to the spring and that point you talk about?
There's a risk of that because it's a respiratory virus. And we know, by the way, Brendan, this is the most studied virus in human history. Isn't that amazing? Which came through this conference. So we know an awful lot about it. It's a respiratory virus.
Yeah, and the most talked about,
they go up in the winter. That's the way it is. So there's a risk of a surge in the winter. But we can contain that surge, remember. The other last thing to say, Brendan, is a lot of talk at the conference, including my own talk, by the way. I spoke about our work in COVID. New therapies. We've got a couple of things in my lab at the moment. A lot of new therapies in hospitals. So that again begins to take the fear away. If someone ends up in hospital, the doctors have more options to treat them, you see, which people forget. So in other words, we can be optimistic. We can plan our way out of this now very clearly. And next spring has become the final part of this in a way, because by then, if it's like the common cold by next spring, then we know we've come through this for definite. You know?
But I'm interested then, just as a final point, you do think, though, that we're possibly being a little bit reckless in terms of stuff like the schools and that we need to maybe hold the line for a bit longer?
I think so, yeah. A few more weeks will be sensible, I think, yeah.
Okay, Luke O'Neill, thank you very much, as always. Luke, guys, is normally on the more optimistic end of things, but Dan, he's sounding a note of caution there about the winter and sounding a note of caution about schools. What do you reckon?
Absolutely. Like, there's uncertainty around this. And of course there is. There always has been. You know, it could be that New Zealand and Australia turn out to have got it right by sealing themselves off completely. That doesn't look likely to be the case, but we don't know. So there is uncertainty. There are new variants. We have to be, have to be vigilant and careful about this. It hasn't gone away.
Okay, Niamh, just on a side note before we leave education and stuff like that, you picked out a piece in the Mail on Sunday by Colin McGurk, First Taste of College Life as Students Let Loose at Last. So
yeah, I suppose this week, you know, the last couple of weeks, certainly in the sector, have been so, so stressful for people, because everyone was coming back on campus. You know, we had heard from students that they wanted kind of face-to-face or more face-to-face than they had. And then this massive accommodation crisis hit. Nobody expected it to be on the scale that it was. Mm. So there was so much stress. But actually what has been lovely to see is, despite all of that, you know, I was driving home the other day and there were students all dressed up and they were going out and they looked like they were just having the best time. And I think particularly for students who are actually starting their second year of study, most of whom are already back, they never had a normal year of college life. They're starting as freshers, even though they're in second year. And it's just wonderful to see them making friends and having all that experience that certainly I had, and I just completely took for granted at the time. It's important to acknowledge the recoveries.
We will not thank you for that, Niamh, because they only like us to hear about how awful things are for them. But it's nice to think that
it is very challenging. And I wouldn't dispute that for a minute.
Is there any easing of the accommodation going on around the UL?
Well, certainly for us, because in Mary Eye, we're a city centre campus, and we've been hit so hard in so many levels. But one of the, for instance, digs are completely gone for a lot of people. Private sector accommodation, private rented accommodation, again, gone for all kinds of reasons. But one of the things, actually, the publicity around it did mean that certain people came out of the woodwork and said, I have a room or I have something. So we did actually manage to get, but it's a huge struggle. It's very much a band-aid. There does have to be a structural response to this if kids aren't going to be excluded from higher education long term.
Dan, from the economist's perspective, is there something gone wrong with the model here, or is it a temporary blip, or what would be your read on it in terms of the student accommodation?
Come back to that catastrophization point. You know, there isn't any successful European country that doesn't have a problem with housing and house prices going up. And why is that? Because interest rates are at rates never seen before in history. And that means people can borrow more. So you see everywhere house prices has been going up, and this is a problem nearly everywhere.
Even the great Germans, whose model of renting and living was held up here for so long, as being, you know, I think 10% in Berlin in the last year, and property's gone up, and there's a real crisis there, isn't there?
And if you listen to the German election campaign, this has come up a lot, housing, and it's a serious issue. Just a point, a fact. Over the Irish housing market cooled back in 2018, You don't hear much about it. And our housing prices have been one of the slowest rising since then.
Really?
Absolutely.
But our rents, Dan, have increased by 11.3% since 2018.
Our rents
since the introduction of rent pressure zones
have also been slowing down. Okay, and so I'm not saying that there's not a problem. There clearly is a big problem. But
I know, if you take Leo Varadkar's comments this week, and he was saying, well, you know, rents are people's wages or they're people's pensions. Like an 11.3% increase in 2 years. I don't know what Leo's pension or wages look like, but that's very, very significant.
Okay, let Dan finish his point, and then, Lewis, I can see you have what I call a quizzical look on your face, so we'll come to you.
So the increase in housing supply has been moving closer to demand. And when that happens, you get the rates of inflation that we had both in house prices and rents have declined. Okay, they have come down. So they're not rising in the really high way that they were 3 or 4 years ago. That's true of both rents and house prices. Now, things have, in recent weeks, there seems to have been, or recent months, there seems to have been an uptick. Maybe that's the post-COVID rebound happening. But, you know, we seem to catastrophize about everything these days. We have a problem.
But has property not gone up 10 or 12%, the price of property, in the last year? Are young people not finding it impossible to get on? People with good jobs can't get a house. People with good jobs can't afford rent in our cities, which is where they should be living, where the good jobs are and where we want people living. Is that not all real, Dan?
Well, of course it's real. I'm just trying to put some sort of context into this, that we have this catastrophic conversation. You know, Ireland had one of the, before COVID, had one of the highest levels of inward migration. Now, if it was so disastrous here in every way, and if it was impossible to find homes, how come we had such a high rate of immigration into the country? So I'm in no way saying that this is not an issue for many people. I'm simply saying, can we just recognise that there is a problem in all of Europe around this because of low interest rates, and that there have been improvements?
But Dan, would you not accept that our inflation problem is more intense than the problem in many other European countries? I mean, to take your example of migration figures, I mean, we have significant inward migration. We also have significant emigration. You know, say if we take our inward migrants, we're in around 30,000. Our emigrants are around 20,000.
Okay, before we go back to Dan, Larissa.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to keep repeating that we mustn't catastrophise, as if we're all some kind of hysterics going around the place making a problem where there is one, or problematising. It's not the case. When something is a catastrophe, it should be called a catastrophe and there should be a catastrophe response. And that's what we have here. And what's happened in housing, I don't even know about house prices because there's no way I'll be able to buy a house. This is a rental crisis, and this is a problem that is a government policy that has been created in the last 7 years. In my view, I've said this before, it's tantamount to treason what this country has done to people. The idea that rents have somehow slowed or gone down is absolute BS and nothing else but that. They have doubled in the last couple of years and they're going up and up every single year because that 4% rent cap is actually an official state rental 4% rise every year that every landlord is doing at the moment, or more or less every landlord. The reality is this. People can go around and say, oh, this doesn't really exist, and, you know, compared to this and every other country, is it's happening here, it's happening there. We're not imagining this. There's a whole section of people, and I'm in that section, that they have good jobs, they are in the professions. For example, I'm in the professions. I work 52 weeks of the year. I work every single week. If I take a week off, I work 2 weeks to get that week off. And I am nowhere near being able to buy a one-bedroom apartment for me and my son. And that is wrong. And that shouldn't be, you know, people can't come in and say, oh, well, from our perspective, you know, as an economist, blah, 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 sorry. The reality is that this is affecting whole swathes of people, more and more people. And there will be a revolution on this soon if it isn't fixed. It's common sense to fix it. It needs to be fixed.
And what you say, treason, like what are they not doing that they should do?
Because this whole thing is government policy. There was a flip in 2014, and I'm sure Dan is aware of this, that social housing was 70% provided by the state, 30% provided by the private landlord. Rents were quite low around the early 2000s. Now we know they've gone further into Celtic, ahead of the Celtic Tiger time. And the flip from 70-30, then it flipped over. 30% provided by the state, 70% provided by the private landlord. When that happened, you had the whole of social housing crowding into the private rental market, which inflated I know there was only a certain percentage of it, but it certainly created this inflation situation within the rental market. And then you have people desperately trying to get out of it. I mean, I think I must have been the only person convinced that house prices would go up in the pandemic, because I knew everyone was going to head off out of Dublin, go home and work from home and save like crazy for a deposit. Mm. Because it is a panic amongst people.
Do you think you'll ever
houses.
Own a house?
No. I actually don't. I've completely lost all hope of it at this stage. And that's very unlike me. I'm as positive as Luke O'Neill about most things in life. But not in this country, I don't think so. I only think that will happen if there's radical change, and that will be a change of government, in my view.
Dan, that's a catastrophe for Larissa or anyone like her, isn't it?
It is a very serious situation for an awful lot of people. But can I ask Larissa this? Why would any government who wants to win votes have a policy to make housing more expensive?
That's a good question. I don't know why.
Well, investors doubled their profit on property over the lifetime of the government's Rebuilding Ireland plan. And I think if you look at government policy, certainly since 2012, 2013, when there was a flip around NAMA and what NAMA was actually about, and what NAMA really did was shift the Irish property market very much towards investor led fiscal policy rather than housing policy. And I think, Dan, it has remained that way. So I think it's government policy that's about fiscal.
If it's not investor led, who should be providing the rental apartments? I mean, this and rental properties, the state can't provide them all, can it?
Yeah, but it can provide enough, Brendan, to take some.
We don't seem to want the mom and pops either in it. They're being driven out.
They're being driven out. It can provide enough to take some of the heat out of the market. So if you go back to Larissa's point, if the state was willing to move back into this, the role of actually building social housing,
the government has spent more money on social housing than at any time in the history of the state.
Yeah, but we're not necessarily building them, and we're doing it in a very expensive way. The government, 2019, the government had spent 1.2 billion during the housing crisis buying 7,200 houses, competing directly with first time buyers.
Do you want the state to become a property developer? Does that
well, the state well? Was, Brendan. You know, yeah. There's generations of people who grew up in council houses that were built in the 1930s and the 1960s.
Do you think they'd be good at it now?
I think they will be better than a lot of the developers would be. I mean, we are in the mess we are because of a developer-led banking crisis, and they made a pretty big pig's ear of it, if you don't mind me saying.
But it's a good question that Dan had there, which is why would a government who wants to stay in power continue to do this? It's a really good question. I don't know why, but all I know is that in 2014, I got a letter from my then landlord telling me that my rent was doubling and that I had 6 or 8 weeks to pay it.
Doubling.
I went out, I got legal advice on that, thinking, sure, this can't be right. The government would stop this in all my naivety. No, it was actually completely allowed at the time. That's only a couple of years ago, the beginning of the rental crisis. That should never have been. There should have been protections in there in the first place. I wrote to every single politician. I still have the emails from that I wrote to all of them, thinking, alert, alert, if he's doing it, they're all going to do it. We're going to have a housing crisis. Nobody did anything about it. And that's because the rents, they wanted the rents to go higher, and it has now got out of control and everybody's being affected. It didn't matter so much when it was a certain class being affected. I notice for some people, that's not my view, but I noticed that socially in the response. And now that it's moving up the ladders, as it always was going to do, and it's affecting middle class people with good wages, now we're finally getting a response. But I feel that it's too late.
Dan, is it too late?
No, as I say, I think things are moving in the right direction. Rates of inflation for both housing and prices have come down. Its building has gone up. Things are moving in the right direction. That does not for a minute mean that it's very difficult for a lot of people. But things are moving in the right direction.
But Dan, and all do the you not think, given the public response to Housing for All, when you think of a number of measures that could have been done fairly immediately, for instance, around vacant site levies, etc., which could have had an immediate impact. We have still, and the UN have highlighted this, we have very weak tenant protections still in Ireland. There are things that could have been done this year. And you know, there was a mantra for a long time in this country of saying, well, the housing crisis can't be fixed overnight. This government, Fine Gael came into government on the 9th of March 2011. We're now in 2021. They've had 10 years. So I think that idea that, well, we have a new answer post, we're getting there. There's no patience or willingness to hear that anymore, because there's a sense that we've had our chance.
I'm not here to tell people what they want to hear. I'm here to say, give my view in terms of the data and the numbers and how things are going. You know, if you want to tell people what they want to hear, that's fine. That's not my job.
Dan, do you think that, like, we've been in situations before? Remember after the bust, when we were told we had way too much property, we had houses, no house should be built in the country until 2035 or something like that, and then suddenly it all changes. Is there going to be a tipping point here where suddenly this is not a crisis anymore? Is that going to happen in the next year or two because of the work that's been done now?
No, I doubt it. I think the only thing that could cause a housing problem to be alleviated is if we go into a very deep recession, that the rebound out of COVID, the economy, ends up being a full stone, and we go into a recession and we get more people leaving and demand for housing falls. So it would be a very bad, the only thing that could cause house prices and rents to fall would be something very bad, a recession that would affect everyone.
Okay, let's take a break. Dan O'Brien, Niamh Horrigan and Larissa Norlin staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Dan O'Brien, Niamh Horrigan and Larissa Norlin still with us. And as you possibly heard the end of there, the conversation continued in a very animated fashion. Listen, I think, okay, we've talked about the housing there, and I'm loath to kind of like give the whole time over to economics, but it does feel like that's where we're at. And we have an economist here with us. And the broader kind of issue that seems to be coming into focus here, I think, a little bit, is that, Dan, you mentioned there that the only way housing could go in the right direction, as in down, would be something very catastrophic. I'm wondering how bad we think things could get now. Niamh, you picked out the front page of the Mail on Sunday there. So yeah. Warnings of 700 million COVID-19 welfare hangover.
It's a really important point, and one that I don't think has been picked up enough. And this is the potential consequences of winding up of the PUP and people who are on the PUP moving on essentially to the live register.
With the point being that a lot of these jobs are not coming back.
Well, this, I mean, if you think of just people in your own circle, like if I think of people I know who work, for instance, in the arts, where there's really been quite a slow recovery in things like audiences coming back. There's an estimate at the moment that could have up to between 60,000 and 70,000 people on the PUP who will join the 180,000 people on the live register, which could potentially add to our social welfare bill of between 650 and 750 million. So that's a big hit on any kind of discretionary spending. Now, I think it's important to be aware that the PUP and the live register are very different beasts in terms of how they deal with unemployment. And certainly people who move from the PUP onto the live register, and I think the Taoiseach referred to this this week, you know, they will be very much oriented towards getting back in the workforce.
Yeah, and it'll be about trying to match them with all these jobs that are there everywhere.
A lot of statements this week from people in construction and hospitality about labour shortages there and the impact there. But nevertheless, on the short term, you're talking about a significant impact on the sums for the budget. And that's really what's being picked out. I mean, if we look at what we know, and again, Pascal Donoghue has this kind of always drip-feeding approach to information on the budget. At the moment, what we seem to be looking at is something in and around 500 million in tax cuts. I have to say, I struggle with that a little bit because
I think we're not allowed to call them tax cuts. They are changing the bands in order
I understand
to allow
that,
people
Brendan,
to
but
keep
like,
any gains they make in line with inflation.
Yeah, the central bank estimated that in the first 3 months of 2021, gross household savings were up by 1.5 billion. So there were people during the pandemic who, because they were at home, did manage to save money, which would suggest that there are certainly certain strata of Irish society, which I'm sure they feel massively that they need a tax cut in the morning. But given the potential spending crisis that we are facing, one wonders as to whether their needs are the most imminent. We also are being told that there's a commitment of around 450 million to social welfare cuts. And there's even still talks about tweaks around that, around family income supplement and dependent kids. And then there seems to be a discretionary amount in or around 550 million. And this is the whole piece around public sector pay. What are the COVID rewards, the MECA crisis? And that's really, it doesn't sound like it, but that's actually quite a small amount of money to try and solve all those other problems with.
Yeah, well, Mike is a billion anyway, isn't it?
Yeah,
at least
yeah. Pascal
Donoghue
has a very significant challenge this week the next weeks ahead.
Dan, a lot of people are clamouring for this new big government having the answers to everyone's difficulties, and everybody with legitimate claims on it all and everything. it's difficult to have fiscal prudence, isn't it, at a time like this?
Quite rightly, when the pandemic struck, fiscal prudence went out the window, and that was absolutely right. The role of the state in an emergency is to intervene, and that was correct. Now, as we emerge from the pandemic, the huge tens of billions the government spent and locked, in many cases, is locked into committed to spending in years to come, we're in a difficult position for the government of finances. That's clear. And if we do have a slump back into recession, we're going to be in a more difficult position. So, you know, we are certainly, you know, my 25 years of looking at economies, I never recall a time when the range of outcomes this time next, for in a year from now, is as big as it is now.
Yeah.
You know, we could, all those savings that Niamh talked about, we could have a consumer boom and that could help the economy. Alternatively, we could get waves of job losses in the sectors that are being supported and won't be supported forever. And we could go into a longer term recession.
Drill into that for a second. You picked out a piece in the Business Post today, government warned of 40,000 hospitality job losses. What do you think the likelihood is that there all these businesses that have been kept alive are going to start going?
Just in the normal course of events, something really strange about the past 18 months in across the Western world has been that when you have a big decline in economies, you get a big increase in the number of companies going bust. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what we amazingly during the COVID period, despite having the biggest economic contraction on record globally, rich countries have been able to support their businesses, and we've actually seen the number of bankruptcies falling in every country that takes numbers. So it's a really unusual thing to happen. And it's because governments have bailed out companies on a huge scale.
Now, so they now need to be left back out into the wild, so to speak.
And when you take away those supports, some businesses are going to go. My real worry is that over the past 18 months, if there had been no pandemic, more businesses would have gone out of business just in the normal course of events, because companies are born and die all the time. So that you've got a backlog of companies that have stayed in business simply because there were supports available. And you're going to get this tsunami effect of corporate bankruptcies coming out, both of the companies that would have gone out of business anyway, nothing to do with COVID, and for those businesses such as in the hospitality sector, which is just not going to go back to normal. You know, people aren't going to be crowding into nightclubs over the winter. It's just not going to be normal. So there's going to be less demand. And it seems to me inevitable that there are going to be job losses in those sort of sectors. So, you know, it's a very uncertain outcome. And one thing I would be pretty sure to say is that, you know, by Christmas, this is not going to be have gone away. COVID's still with us. And there are going to be longer term ramifications from all of this.
Yeah. Okay.
Brendan, that's one of the positive things, I suppose, as somebody who worked in higher ed during the banking crisis, and because people who were kind of subcontracting and construction and stuff, they had nothing in the way of welfare when the crisis actually hit. And a lot of them came into higher ed, and I would have been talking to them at the time, and they were absolutely determined that their families would never go into construction again because of that experience. And we're living with the consequences of that now, you know, because we have shortages in that sector. So in some ways, the PUP, I think, has a softening piece around, you know, sectors and employment and people saying, I'm never going to do that again. Because I'm sure you're aware there was a campaign in the UK last year where they had a picture of a ballet dancer and she said, oh, you know, this gorgeous girl, now she's working in cyber. You know, so some of the sectors, while they might not recover quickly, you would hope that there will be a recovery in the long term more. And I do think the PUP helped soften that. So I think it definitely did have its place, but it is undoubtedly that place is starting to erode now.
Yeah, Larissa,
I do think that it's
there.
Worth reading Justine McCarthy's piece in the Sunday Times today. She talks about the possibility, or what she's predicting really, as a kind of a flight of the youth out of Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're looking at, say, you know, lengthy dole queues and there's, you know...
compares a lot of the prices of
in different.
Of
yeah, she goes
across.
Through all the cost of living in different cities across Europe. But, you know, it's interesting because, like, for example, my own sister is in Geneva and she pays the same rent as I do, but she's living in Geneva, you know, and also wages
are... Yeah, you're living in Dublin.
Well, I mean...
We're just as good as Geneva.
Well, I don't know about that, but I would say that maybe when it comes to, specifically when it comes to wages, we're not as good as Geneva, certainly, far, far higher.
So do you think we could see a flight of young people out of here?
Yeah, I think I agree with Justine. I I mean, what really is there here to hold them? If you're looking at a situation where, you know, you're going to be paying an average of €2,000 a month in rent in the city centre, or living at home with your parents until you're 30. If you can find another place, and she lists many of them where things might be a bit better for you, I can see that she might have, there's some wisdom in what she's saying there. It's worth a read anyway. Very well written piece, as usual, from Justine.
Okay. So the conclusion of all that is that, Dan, you are saying that it could go either way, really.
Yeah, I think there's this is clearly, we've never had a pandemic recession like this. You know, the Spanish flu was the last time, and everyone reacted very differently to that. So we've never had an experience of how this affects an economy when you hugely increase subsidies for businesses and ramp up welfare, and then you try and take it away. So we just have no experience, historical experience, of how this could go, and therefore it's very difficult to know which will it go. Will it be negative? Will those scarring effects on the economy from all of this period be negative, or can we bounce back and everybody will spend again?
You're writing in your column in the Business Post today about Germany, and I think a lot of us have been paying a bit more attention to Germany over the last week with the election there and everything. And as we kind of alluded to earlier, there's a lot of similarities to the issues that people are facing in Germany, isn't there? This is going to matter for us, isn't it?
It'll matter for us a lot in the sense that the government has really just opened the spending taps here. We've been one of the highest increase in spending, government spending, since the pandemic. And, you know, listening to politicians these days, you kind of get the sense that, you know, let's spend on everything now, and as though there's no constraint. And one of the reasons for that is that during the pandemic, the rules for countries in the Eurozone on how much they can spend and how much their deficits can be were suspended. So the government has basically had a free rein to spend as much as it wants. And there's been no concern about Eurocrats from Brussels saying you're going too far. That's going to change. Those rules will come back in some form.
Is tightening in the air already, like of all this stimulus and everything?
I wouldn't say it's imminent, in the sense that the pandemic is still here. And I think there's a recognition across Europe that you can't just pull away these supports immediately. You've got to support.
There does seem to be an impatience with just pumping out stimulus, though, developing, is there?
Well, the reason it's all been able to happen is because the European Central Bank is printing money to support governments. Now, that is, nobody thinks that's a good idea, and nobody thinks that's sustainable in the long term. So if something is not sustainable in the long term, it'll have to stop. Now, the Germans have traditionally are one, the most powerful country in Europe, particularly in the Eurozone, and two, they're traditionally much more fiscally conservative than we are, and Southern European countries. You know, there are votes in balancing budgets in Germany. There's no votes in Ireland for a politician to say, I'll balance the budget. Nobody will ever win an election on that. In Germany, you win elections by saying, I'm very prudent, I'll balance the budget, we'll get our deficit down. And it depending on who gets elected today, if it's a right-leaning government in Germany, in other words, if Angela Merkel's party gets back in with another right-leaning party, then they will probably accelerate the reintroduction of the rules, and Ireland's next budget, not the coming one this year, but will be impacted by those new rules, whatever shape they
take. So they might as well enjoy themselves with this budget, really, while they can. Niamh, on not winning any elections by balancing budgets, you picked out a piece in the Sunday Independent today, Jody Corcoran, obsessed with failure and tacking left, what's Leo's big idea? And this is, I suppose, the first socialist T-shirt since Bertie Ahern. The first socialist T-shirt since Bertie Ahern, the way he's tracking at the moment.
Yeah, it was an interesting speech that Leo made this week in terms of spending, and he Jody Corcoran's piece is really interesting in that it kind of harks back to, I suppose, what was the initial leadership competition between Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar, and the way in which Simon Coveney in particular kind of invoked the ideas around the Just Society, which obviously are long-standing within Fine Gael and tend to be the more left-leaning part of Fine Gael, and Leo Varadkar, who's always been seen very much as an advocate of a more neoliberal approach, and he argued that Leo's speech this week week. And I think Pat Leahy had a piece, something similar, in the Irish Times yesterday, which again focused the interesting, you know, the idea of Leo invoking ideas like, you know, care economy and looking after people and welfare.
You welcome this, I presume, do you?
Well, I welcome a care economy in any shape or form. But the cynic's read of the whole thing is that Leo is hoping very much for a kind of a COVID bounce, an idea that, well, the government managed COVID quite well. And therefore, by this emphasising on the kind of post-COVID period and kind of, you know, continuing on from the solidarity. Now, of course, that is, you know, if we look at people around the world who've invoked those ideas, David Cameron was a big invokee of the big society, which wouldn't have been a million miles away from what, and they ended up cutting $25 billion out of their welfare budget. So I would take all of this with a grain of salt.
You believe it when you see it. Yeah. Dan, you were at the event where the Taoiseach spoke, weren't you?
I was indeed.
Yeah. How did it go down with the assembled masses of IBEC?
I would have thought they would have been groaning at some points when he was outlining some of the stuff that's going to cost businesses money. But I suppose they're too polite and it was too small an event. It was very, obviously, with the rules, very limited number of people there. But, you know, it's certainly, a lot of these measures clearly will not be go down well with business, because it'll cost business, it'll raise costs for business. And, you know, you raise costs for businesses, some businesses at the margin don't survive then if costs go up. These things don't come, you know, it's not as though you can create utopia by enacting a law or putting a new policy in place. You know, the world's always going to have its problems.
Okay, I want to talk about something before we finish up that I think out in the real world, outside of the hallowed walls of this studio, has been a big talking point for people this week, and that is Linda Evangelista. And I know that, Larissa, you were looking at Eilish O'Hanlon had a piece in it today. Can you just tell us what the story is in a nutshell first?
Yeah, essentially we have Linda Evangelista, who was, and in my view is, one of the most beautiful women in the world. And she has told how she got a cosmetic treatment to freeze her fat cells. So essentially it was quite dramatic cosmetic procedure to keep her looking as beautiful as she always has been. And it went wrong, essentially. And she says that she's, I think the word she used is disfigured or permanently deformed, actually, is what she says. And I it's really interesting to hear how she spoke about this. She says she now suffers from a cycle of deep depression, profound sadness, and the lowest depths of self-loathing. Now, to admit something like that in relation to your outward appearance, you know, I mean, there's a lot of talk about breaking stigmas and being brave by saying this or that. I actually think in this case she was, because there's an argument to be had that when it comes to beauty, it's not so much not looking well that people get shamed for or looking well, but it's in the effort that you put into it and the admission of what you do to attain that. So a lot of us kind of like to, you know, we do things and then we pretend it's all natural or whatever. But I mean, this the piece that Eilish comes back to, the point that she comes back to, which is a really important one, actually, is that, you know, there's a lot of talk about progress for women and feminism and all that. And, you know, for me, a lot of that was lip service. It was a lot of the time used to add another zero onto somebody's pay packet in many ways. But I don't think a lot of things changed for women. I think that they just shifted around. And in line with that supposed progress for women in the last 5 or 6 years, I think that the pursuit of perfection and the pursuit of beauty has gone way, way more than it ever was. Certainly,
yeah, okay.
Certainly for when I was a younger woman, that wasn't at those levels. And I grew up in the supermodels era, but I think it seems to be has accelerated.
That everyone has to aspire to that. No,
yeah.
Eilish makes the point that when she was in college, you threw on jeans and a top and went off, and that now girls are afraid to leave the house unless they're done up to the nines. Is that something you'd be noticing?
It would, but also, in fairness, not just girls, but guys and girls and everyone. You know, they're taking photographs of themselves and posting them on social media, and other people are commenting and saying you look great. So that idea of, I suppose, the gaze and being perfect for the gaze is, I think, a fantastic driver of all of this, and particularly because part of the tools of social media is to perfect those images, so to use things like Photoshop and filters and all that kind of stuff. I actually thought this was an incredibly sad piece, because one would argue that, you know, there, you know, and again, social media has been a very significant driver of this around kind of inclusivity around body and around appearance, about women accepting aging. The differently able movement in particular have made huge strides, I think, around this whole idea of unpicking this idea of what is the perfect body. And I thought her frankness was laudable, but I thought it was really sad that she feels like this. And it is, you know, Helen of Troy. There's a great book about Hazel Lavery, which talks about, you know, being a woman who's defined by her appearance, and then your appearance is going. And you know, so one element, it's an age old problem, but it's playing out as a very kind of a contemporary.
Yeah, and I think
a
big issue I think we do need to address in this is this idea that you can fight against aging. I mean, like, just that's a losing battle. That's always going to be a losing battle. But it must come down to some deep psychology around mortality and the fear of mortality.
Yeah. And there's a psychological issue. They're starting them younger and younger now all the time. The pressure to, you have to do pre-preventative Botox in your 20s and all this.
Yeah.
Okay, Dan, I'm going to let discretion be the better part of valour on that one for you. Okay, so look, thank you very much, Larissa Nolan, Niamh Horrigan and Dan O'Brien. And we need to take a quick break now.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.